This is April 6th, 2014, and today I'm going to use a koan to look at a lot of things about Zen and the world generally. This is from the Blue Cliff Record, one of the two most famous collections of koans. This is number 28. In Japanese, the Blue Cliff Record is called the Hekiganroku. And this is titled Nonsense Untaught Dharma. Here we'll use the Japanized names. Nansen is his real Chinese. These are Chinese masters. Nansen is the Japanese name of Nanshuan, and the other guy in here, Hyakujo, is Japanese. That's the Japanese name, and he's Baijiang. But just to keep it simple, I'm just going to use the Japanese names. So Nansen went to see Abbot Hyakujo Nehan, a senior brother monk. Hyakujo said, "Is there a Dharma which none of the patriarchs has ever preached?" Nansen said, "Yes." Hyakujo said, "What is it?" Nansen said, "It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not anything." Hyakujo said, "There, you're teaching, aren't you?" Nansen said, "I just say this. How about you?" Hyakujo said, "I'm not a man of great wisdom, so how would I know?" Nansen said, "I don't know either." Hyakujo said, "I have already spoken too much to be of any use to you." Now, I'm going to forego reading biographical material on these two we've often read about the great Nanshuan or Nansen. He was one of the great Tang Dynasty masters. He was the master of Joshu or Zhaozhou. The other one, who's referred to here as Abbot Hyakujo Nehan, is not the illustrious master that we usually think of as Hyakujo, Baijiang Weihai. This is just a senior brother monk of Nanshuan. So although he's not the really famous Hyakujo or Baijiang, he was a Dharma successor to the really famous Hyakujo. Here, Nansen, according to the sources I consulted with, Nansen was quite young. So, and he's going to a senior monk, and this monk, Hyakujo, takes the lead and asks the visitor, the young visitor, Nansen or Nanshuan, "Is there a Dharma which none of the patriarchs has ever preached?" There's another koan, this one in the Mumonkan, that is the same as the first half of this one. And that's a very provocative question. Is there a truth which has never been taught or preached by any, even the greatest masters? And Nansen says, "Yes." Well, we can get a sense of how this can be, some great truth which has never been taught explicitly by any of the, even the greatest masters, from an exchange with one of Nansen's most famous Dharma heir, Joshu, Zhaozhou, where the monk asked Zhaozhou, "Is there any Buddhist teaching in the remote mountains when no one is present?" To which Joshu replied, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." There, that's one. So we might ask, is there a Dharma? What is Dharma mean? And this, well, there are many thousands of volumes of texts, hundreds of years old, where the Dharma, in that sense, the truth, the law, is presented in many, 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 many ways. The most well-known ways start with the Four Noble Truths, that the suffering is pervasive, that the cause of this suffering is egoistic attachment and delusion, that there's a way out of this suffering, and the way out is by realizing that none of us is separate. We are all in intertwined, interdependent. That's one way of understanding the fourth, the way out, the path out of suffering. There are other ways. So starting with the First Noble Truth, life, suffering is pervasive, life is dissatisfaction is pervasive, anxiety is pervasive. We see this everywhere. Certainly we see it in ourself. Who is ever absolutely satisfied? And then we see it, we see suffering everywhere we look if we have a mind to see it. We see it in the most spectacular ways, in the news, and in less dramatic ways, just in our own family, our work environment. It's right there. We see, here's another little nugget of the Dharma, as formally presented, is the three poisons of greed. Usually they're referred to as greed, anger, and delusion. Anger is the most common way. That second one is presented, the word anger, but it could be ill will, enmity, hostility. It's just anger is very simple, common two-syllable word. The others are less common. There was a time many years ago when I was looking hard at these three poisons and considered changing anger to ill will or enmity, which is a broader way to understand the second of the three poisons. But most translations render it as anger, so we just stick with anger. But hostility or ill will in any of its many, 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 many forms, from the faintest kind of irritation to the most fearsome kind of rage and hatred and wrath that we can see and read about. We don't need to go to the remote mountains when no one is present to see this Dharma of greed, anger, and delusion. Certainly we see it in politics. Those who follow politics at all. It's on grand parade. The greed, the corruption, the ill will in Congress and locally even, the confusion. This is a little less obvious. The word, the third poison, confusion, sometimes it's translated as folly. That's a good one. Look around at what goes on in government, what goes on outside of government. Folly, confusion, delusion. Really, delusion, this third poison, most basically is believing in separation, in self and other, and us and them. I reflected on some big headlines recently. Big news stories recently, besides all of the ongoing mess in politics, which is not a new thing. It's been going on forever when human beings get together and have to share power, or somehow find a way to wield power, then there is greed, hostility, and delusion. Scandals. There's going to be never an end to scandals in by public officials, and this is, there it is. There's the Dharma that no one needs to teach. Racism. There it is. Us and them. Division. Delusion. I feel, as many people do, growing sympathy for young people who are left saddled with huge debt from college, and if that weren't bad enough, difficulty finding a job. What has caused tuition and college education to soar in cost so much? Well, there's an element. There's got to be an element of greed there. So, three poisons. If you run out of places to see the teaching of three poisons, turn the mind inward. And then here's one of my favorite, because it is one of the most basic of all Buddhist concepts, is the three characteristics of existence. Change, suffering, there's suffering again, we covered that. Check, suffering, done with suffering. Suffering, impermanence, and no self. Change, of course, like suffering, is everywhere. In fact, suffering comes out of change, or rather comes from our attachments, mostly mental attachments. Too many people think attachments means attachments to little pleasures that they may have. That's on kind of attachments, but the real bedeviling attachments are clinging to our notions about people and things, our opinions, our ideas and concepts. These are the real problematic attachments. And we get attached to things as we understand them, and then change pulls the rug out from under us, which leads to suffering. Current events, weather, there's change for you. If only it would change sooner here in Rochester. But there's something wonderful about the weather, because it remains something. It remains part of the ever-shrinking category of things that we can't manipulate, and to manipulate to accord with our preferences, our likes and dislikes. Something that's wonderful to have to accommodate ourselves to the weather. Maybe there'll be some day when there'll be some remarkable new development where human beings can actually change the weather to match what they want. But for now, it's another teaching of impermanence. It's also a teaching of the interplay of the two extremes, of differences. I found a passage from an old rich source of Chinese Zen anecdotes and dialogues called the Golden Age of Zen. It's about Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. It's by John Wu. I've read from him many times, as has Roshi Kaplow. So again, what is popularly known as the yin and yang, the two aspects, the two apparent opposites of which everything we could say reflects. And here he's talking about Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch. And we're reading, he says, in his last instruction to his disciples, he enumerated no less than 36 pairs of opposites, such as light and darkness, yin and yang, form and the formless, the phenomenal and the void, activity and tranquility, the pure and the muddy, the worldly and the saintly, the monk and the layman, the great and the small, long and short, perversion and rectitude, delusion and wisdom, klesha and bodhi. This means our afflictions and our innately enlightened nature. Kindness and cruelty, permanent and impermanent, real and unreal, joy and anger, advance and retreat, birth and death, spiritual body and physical body, etc. Then he quotes Wei Nung, if you know the proper way of using these pairs of opposites, you will be able to go freely in and out through the sutra dharmas, steering clear of the two extremes by letting the self nature stir and function spontaneously. In conversation with others, externally be detached from phenomena in the midst of phenomena. Internally be detached from the void in the midst of the void. Then he says, if someone asks you about the meaning of existence, answer him in terms of non-existence. If he asks about the worldly, speak of the saintly. If he asks of the saintly, speak of the worldly. In this way, the interdependence and mutual involvement of the two extremes will bring to light the significance of the mean. Suppose someone asks you, what is darkness? Answer him thus. Light is the primary cause of darkness, and darkness is the secondary cause of light. It is the disappearance of light that causes darkness. Light and darkness exhibit each other, and their interdependence points inevitably to the significance of the mean. Well, this is a little bit abstract, but really I think the point is that everything is the interpenetration or the interdependence of any polarities, any opposites that we can come up with. Everything has its opposite within it. And maybe most importantly, in terms of our everyday life, is the non-dual nature of our afflictions, human afflictions, and human human wisdom. This is a basic insight that comes through awakening, is that you can't ever separate these two. How could you, when it is our nature, enlightenment is our nature. We have this complete, perfect self-nature. So that is always the ground, that's the basis. But because of our conditioning, our ignorance, we have all of these defilements, these afflictions that cause us and others so much suffering. But we couldn't get away from our innate perfection if we wanted to. And that's just a marvelous thing to keep in mind. Certainly, when we encounter our own afflictions through the revealing process of meditation, we see ever more subtle layers of greed, hostility, and delusion. But not to get snagged by that and think that somehow we are without this true nature. But then we can also see it in others. So just to do a little mental exercise here, conflict. Conflict, opposition, argumentation. This is just so painful to see how Congress can't get anything done anymore because of the perception, especially on the part of one side, that a compromise is somehow a weakness, and so people dig in, and as a result, it's just absolutely scandalous how little is done because of the rigid attachment to ideology. But what there's got to be in that. There has to be an aspect of our true nature functioning. It's a longing for purity. That's what attachment to ideology is. It's wanting to hold fast, to be true to one's principles as one understands them. There's a something as ruinous as addiction to alcohol or drugs has its own has embedded in it this longing for wholeness. There's a passage written by William James in his book The Varieties of Religious Experience, in which he acknowledges the other side of this terrible compulsion. He's talking here about alcohol, but we can, you know, it also, of course, means drugs or any substance abuse, shopping, food, internet addiction. But let me read here. The sway of alcohol over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature. Usually crushed to earth by the cold facts and dry criticisms of the sober hour. Sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. It is, in fact, the great exciter of the yes function in man. It brings its votary, its people, from the chill periphery of things to the radiant core. It makes him, for the moment, one with truth. Not through mere perversity do men run after it. To the poor and the unlettered, it stands in the place of symphony concerts and of literature, and it is part of the deeper mystery and tragedy of life that whiffs and gleams of something that we immediately recognize as excellent should be vouchsafed to so many of us only in the fleeting earlier phases of what in its totality is so degrading a poisoning. The drunken consciousness is one bit of the mystic consciousness, and our total opinion of it must find its place in our opinion of that larger whole. Lest anyone hear this and grasp, lunge for it as rationalization for abusing substances, of course, surely everyone here knows that that's what's so tragic about it, is that it springs from, it has to spring, everything springs from this true nature. And this longing for wholeness, for oneness, to overcome the sense of separation, the illusion of separation, and that how tragic that in doing this it is so destructive, self-destructive above all, but also destructive of others. It's such a terrible failure and perversion of our highest, our most exalted aspirations to take this form. But right there in that drunkenness and that drug addiction is a dharma that none of the patriarchs has ever preached. It's all around us, it's everywhere, it's everything, this dharma that no patriarch has ever preached. Russia's annexation of Crimea. If you dig deep enough, it springs from fear, fear of division, fear of being swallowed up on the part of Putin and Russia, and so there is this reaction, which you can also see as another twisted, destructive form of wanting to overcome division, separation. We were talking about the three characteristics of existence: suffering, change, and no self. Every time we see someone in our own personal life or elsewhere who does something that is out of character, it's an expression of no self. There's no fixed, permanent self that we can rely on. Without a self, that means that we... Another way of understanding no self is that the so-called self, such as it is, a certain kind of continuity in our personality and character, not an absolute continuity, but a relative continuity, that is relational, that it reflects our environment to an extent, that we may think of ourselves in a certain way. I'm the type of person who, but that is to some extent, not entirely, some extent, a function of an effect of our surroundings, the people we're with, the environment we're in. Because we know that, you know, if we change our environment, if we go somewhere that where our vulnerabilities will be reinforced, then we're going to act in a way that we don't think of as ourselves. I wasn't myself. That's the teaching of no self. Change, impermanence. One of the most remarkable things of this decade in the last 10 years is the galloping acceptance of gay marriage. There's so many people I've heard and read who are just amazed at how suddenly, relatively speaking, how suddenly this has changed into acceptance of people, of same-sex people getting married, or just plain homosexuality being accepted. Who would have thought 10 or especially 20 or 30 or 50 years ago that this would happen, this turn so fast? What a wonderful change in terms of acceptance, non-judgmental qualities. Impermanence, one of the three characteristics of existence. Look at fashion. Look at anything. It's all there. It's all presenting the Dharma of change. In the Blue Cliff Record, elsewhere, not this koan, but another one, there is an unknown, a previous master, Zen master, who said the following: if you want to know the meaning of Buddha nature, you must observe times and seasons, causes and conditions. Times and seasons, causes and conditions. Everything, phenomena, everything that we're embedded in, the whole world as we know it, this whole phenomenal world of change. There's a koan in another collection, the Book of Serenity, or the Shoyoroku, very short one where monk asks the master, what is the Dharma? Or what is Buddha? They're the same thing. What is ultimate truth? And his response was, what is the price of rice in Ling Ning? It's a province that the monk had come from. What's the price of gas in Michigan? Buddha nature, like it could ever be something apart from this world that we live in with all of its flux. People who are glued to celebrity life, who have to every day hear what's going on with celebrities or the personal lives of famous people, great athletes, and scandals of every kind. That itself, of course, that is not going to help you realize your true nature, but it is another expression of this truth, this Dharma. There's a Chinese proverb, lonely study in the mountains reveals less than listening to strangers at a crossroad. One of my own lingering attachments is to the news, as well as the weather. But I'm so endlessly fascinated by how the Dharma presents itself in new ways, and no, not always, sometimes old ways, week after week, month after month, how these things that grab the headlines and all is just more iterations of the Dharma. All right, so back to our koan. Is there a Dharma which none of the patriarchs has ever preached? Nansen said, yes. And then the elder, Hyakujo, said, what is it? And Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not anything. If we think of it as if we conceptualize it, this Dharma that has never, no patriarch ever, if we conceptualize it as mind or Buddha, then we miss it. It is not any single thing. And this gets right to the heart of Zen. Anything, any word or concept we give it will be inadequate. It's beyond things. Or it's the things in their no thingness. And then Hyakujo comes back. There, you're teaching, aren't you? Right there. So this is Dharma fencing, Dharma combat, where they're each trying to snag the other in some kind of little trap. So there, you're teaching, aren't you? And then Nansen comes back. I just say this. How about you? They're just keep hitting it back over the net, each one. And then Hyakujo said, I am not a man of great wisdom, so how would I know? Well, if he is a man of great wisdom, he certainly would not think of himself as a man of great wisdom. That would be another kind of attachment. I'm such and such a person. Every time I hear someone, usually it's not Sangha people, but others, every time I hear someone say, I'm the kind of person who, it makes me wince. Because they're just binding themselves into attachment to a notion about themselves. Yeah, at any given time, you might be a kind of person who likes to help other people, let's say, or wants to be left alone. Any thousands of ways you could complete that sentence. I'm the type of person who... But every time you use a construction like that, every time we make ourselves into a noun, then we are falling away from the way things are, because things are not nouns. Things are in process. Things are in flux. We are in flux. Our bodies are the Dharma, which none of the patriarchs ever preached. I read recently in a review of a book about cancer that the cells in our bodies, each cell divides 4 million times a second. 4 million times a second. If that isn't flux, what is? I just say this, how about you? I'm not a man of great wisdom, so how would I know? Nonsense said, I don't know either. What do we know? What do we ever really know? We don't really, really know anything we read about or hear about because it's mediated. We're not experiencing it directly. I've been fascinated by the saturation coverage of the disappearance of the Malaysian airline on CNN. Every time I turn on CNN, every time, there is ongoing coverage in all different peripheral ways of this mystery of what happened to the Malaysian airline flight. Now, these aren't the people who schedule this broadcasting. They're not fools as far as prophets. They do it for the reason that they are convinced that this mystery is compelling for enough people, enough hundreds of thousands or millions of people, that they'll keep watching it. What is that? What is so compelling for so many millions of people about this mystery? Something we don't know. There's the human element, the sympathy for the loss. People who publish magazines know the same thing. That's why so often on the covers of magazines, when you're standing in a checkout line, you see at least a majority, if not a high majority, of magazines to grab your attention. They pose the topics that are inside, they pose them as questions. Watch it. It's everywhere. Questions draw us in. Mysteries draw us in. Fat, good or bad? Carbohydrates, good or bad? Justin Bieber, good or bad? They find all kinds of ways of raising it as a question. And the same, even NPR has these teases at the beginning of an hour. Well, they make it as a question. If they make it as a statement, okay, you know. You're less likely to listen. Make it as a question, okay, now you're intrigued. So we can't absolutely know. We don't even know, we don't really know for sure that anyone ever landed on the moon. I mean, most of us, I certainly believe it, but how do we know? We weren't on the moon. We rely on mediated sources of information, the news, hearsay. But even our own experience is not entirely reliable. We know how unreliable our eyewitness reports of crimes. People were there, they saw it. And yet it turns out 30 years later, when someone wrongfully convicted is exonerated, that they gave false testimony, unknowingly in many cases. So if we can't trust mediated information and we can't entirely trust our own our own senses, what we see and hear, well, what can we trust? Well, we have to trust something. That's how we move through life. driving along at 55 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour on a country road, the way we do on the way to Chapin Mill, and there are cars coming, just one lane each direction. There are cars coming at the same speed, 60 miles an hour. How do we know that that approaching car won't just suddenly swerve and crash into us at 60 miles an hour and kill us? So we have to trust some to move through life. We have to have some trust in what we can't possibly know, just to make our way. So this is almost the end of the koan. I'm not a person of great wisdom. I don't know. How would I know? I don't know either. And then there's just a little ending where Hyakujo said, "I've already spoken too much to be of any use to you. I have already spoken too much to be of any use to you." Stop now and recite the four vows.